Well, I'm going to pray, and then we're going to jump into Ruth. I'll introduce you a few things about the book of Ruth. You all know the story of Ruth, but we've got to fit it in the sequence between Judges and 1 Samuel. Why is it there? And again, it's kind of obvious. It's talking about the lineage of the king. It fits perfectly with the time of the Judges as far as what's going on in the culture. But what is interesting is, there's many things that are interesting, but Ruth is the name of a woman who is a Moabite. She's the only Gentile named in any of the books. You know, Samuel's a Jew. All the prophets are Jewish. So this is the only, you get in the New Testament, you're going to have the name of Luke. Luke would be a Gentile. But Ruth is the only non-Israel named in a book. And they named it Ruth, which is interesting. Because the main character is not Ruth. She's like a supporting character, if you really understand, if you make the decision as you read the book. But the story is really about Naomi, who comes in and she's got a pleasant life, and then she goes through some loss, and she's empty, and she ends up in a worshipful state. So the story, it begins with Naomi, goes through Naomi's loss, brings her back home, and she has a son or a grandson, Obed, who's going to become the father of Jesse, who's going to become the father of David. And that's all about Naomi's place in history. So the book is really about Naomi and her rise and fall. But the main conversation is going to be Boaz. Boaz is the one who does the most talking in the book. So the story is really, it's the dialogue of Boaz, the story of Naomi, but named after Ruth, a Moabite, the second character or supporting character in the book. At least that's one way of looking at the whole thing. So anyway, I'll pray, and we'll jump into this and take a look at it. Father, we come to you again tonight. We do thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word. We do ask that we may hear these things tonight, that we may make application to our own lives. But Father, we do thank you for your consistency of giving promises, of fulfilling promises, or making plans and seeing those plans to the end. And Father, we find ourselves in a place in history where we are standing between promises. We're standing in the process of your plan being worked out, and we rejoice in the fact that we know that you will be successful, that you will bring us to completion, and that we will be with you in eternity and in your kingdom. And we ask, Father, that we'd serve you well at this time as we stand here and wait for your return. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, the notes, first of all, you can see the notes there. I'll put a map up very quickly. Here is the Dead Sea. Jerusalem would be right about here. Of course, that's a Jebusite city. We talked about that last week. Coming out of Bethlehem was the Levite who did not want to stop at Jabesh, the Canaanite city, but continued on up to a town of Benjamin. But now we're back in Bethlehem here, and there's a family that's going to be here. When Naomi leaves, she's going to go over to Moab. Moab is down here, and we've gone through Moab. We've talked about Moab. She could have gone around, but it's possible also she could have gone right across there. Even when we were there, you can see that it dries up, and there's times, especially since this is a time of a famine as the story begins, the Dead Sea could have looked like this. And that's not unusual. We saw that when we were there. You could walk across it when it gets dry. And today, they're irrigating water. Both Jordan and Israel's irrigating water. So not as much water is getting to the Dead Sea. And so it's low today. But they might have crossed there. David, the same way. When David goes over to Moab, remember, there's going to come a time in David's life where he's going to flee from Saul. He's going to take his family out of Bethlehem, and he's going to take them where? Over to the king of Moab and say, take care of my family. And why does David do that? Well, that's his family over here too, because his great-grandmother is from Moab. And so he's David, as you figured out, he's a good part of his lineage is not just from the tribe of Judah, but a good portion of it's from Moab. And then you think about Solomon. Solomon has also got an eighth Moab, but then his mom would be a Hittite. And so he's half Hittite, one-eighth Moab, and that'd leave three-eighths of his heritage of being Jewish. Is that not interesting about Solomon, that he is more Hittite than he is Jewish? Anyway, that's a little bit about that. Anyway, the other things here on this sheet of paper, at the very bottom I got a picture of Tony there standing in outside of Bethlehem. That's what the outside of Bethlehem would look like. It was a very fertile place here in Bethlehem. In fact, the city is named after its fact that it can produce so much bread, so much grain can be produced in this area. As you look at the top, we've got a little bit about the timing, and Arlen helped me with this. Arlen, make sure I did this correctly. Where does the book of Ruth fit? And, of course, it's not dated, and so we're putting pieces together. So there's room to question and readjust, relook at things, bring some other things forward. But here's one way of putting the book of Ruth in perspective is David was born around 1040 B.C. He began to rule around 1005 B.C. As we put this together, you've got David, as you know, you've got David whose father is Jesse. And Jesse, since David is the eighth son, the youngest, Jesse could have been, 60 years old before David was born. So that would put Jesse being born around 1100. And Jesse was born to Obed, who is going to be Ruth's son, Obed, Naomi's grandson. And let's just say Obed was 50 years old. Just grab a number. You could say 30 if you want to, but we're going to say 50. That puts Obed being born around 1150. If you want to say Obed was 30 years old when Jesse was born, that would make the story of Ruth happening around 1130 B.C. So I'm just going to write here for the story here. 1150 B.C. Is when the story takes place. And then, of course, Obed's father is Boaz. And we'll take a look at the genealogy here in a little bit. But that kind of puts it in perspective around 1150. This is going to be about 45 years before Samuel's born. Or the story of Ruth takes place about 50 years before Samuel is born. When we turn the page, after we get done with Ruth tonight, we turn the page, we're in 1 Samuel, and we're now talking about another woman named Hannah who's looking to have a son during this time period of the Judges, because Samuel is the last judge. So we've finished the book of Judges, but we haven't finished the Judges, nor have we finished the time period of the Judges, because Ruth is part of the time period of the Judges. Samuel is going to be born, grow up, and become the last judge of Israel and hand the kingdom over to the first king, Saul. And so this is going to take place. He's going to be born right around this time, say 1105 or 1100 B.C. So that kind of puts that in perspective. Another thing we can put in here, and Arlen pointed this out, before Samson, and then it would be Jephthah. Remember Jephthah over here when he was down here fighting the Ammonites over in this area? It's going to be right around. This would be similar time of Jephthah. Now, something else that's interesting. Look at this date, 1150. Again, that's a ballpark figure, maybe 1130, maybe 1160 or something. I got this. This has been popping up at different places online that I've been looking at. And there's a link right there that I'll put it live on the website when you can just click on it if you want to. But I cut and pasted this article right here because archaeology records, they record these events, that the time of the judges between, let's say 1250 to 1100 B.C., during this time period of the judges, we just got them to talk about, was a time of upheaval, of turnover, of the falling or the decline of the Egyptians, the Macedonians, Mesopotamians. The Greeks themselves, further to the west, were undergoing a political change, and there's some turmoil there. And that was so some of the great countries, the great empires, the Hittites, were declining at this time. And so that's going to leave some space for things like the countries like the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Israelites, the small players on the stage of history to have a place to kind of rise up, take some territory, put up some boundary stones and say, we're in charge of this area and become little kingdoms. Because before this time, we know from our previous studies, we know from archaeology, Egypt controlled all of Canaan. They may have had kings up here, but they were under the authority of the Egyptians. Egypt has retreated, and that leaves this open for Israel to come in to drive out the Canaanites that were working with the Egyptians, and kind of sets the stage. Now, what caused this decline of all these empires? Here's one of the things they find out right here. It's about pollen. Pollen at least shows, one of the things that shows is that there was a decline. I've got it underlined there. I've got a little quote right there in the middle of the page. It says, ancient pollen yields dramatic finds at the Sea of Galilee. And going down there to right about the time where it has the bold underlined, I cut and pasted that from the article. But there's it corresponds to a drought that heightened in the years between 1250 and 1100 B.C. So the pollen remains shows that there was a drought going on between 1250 and 1100 B.C. during this same time period. It's just interesting. Ruth is going to begin by saying there was a famine in the land, and they're going to leave to go over to Moab. But it kind of sets the stage for the declining of the empires, the rise of these little states or little kingdoms that are going to be here. Talks about the famine. It also mentions, we find other places as far as archaeology and as they study, there was a series of earthquakes earthquakes that took place and would have caused some climate change. There was a climate change that took place here, something that upset the environment, that caused famine, caused drought, the lack of crops, and people were kind of scrambling, and empires began to decline. That leads to then a group of people coming from the west called the Sea People, trying to find a place to settle, a place to take care of their families, a place to move on, that we know them as the Philistines, that settled in the land of Israel over there in the Gaza Strip at this time. So what I just threw at you was a bunch of information, but what's interesting is the Bible is dealing with all that without coming out and saying it specifically. It fits that story. Archaeology has been talking about it for years. Now Pollan and other research is finding out that that is exactly what. And look how close the dates are. The dates are just overlapping each other. It fits. So nonetheless, that's a little bit of introduction here to our story. Historically and archaeologically, and even in the news, recently in the news. I got some little information right there at the bottom of the page, the last about 7 or 8 lines that I was referring to earlier. In fact, the last 4 lines. Ruth carries the story as being the one of the main characters, although the story is about Naomi. There are of the 85 verses in this book, that doesn't sound like very much. That's why I'm taking so much time introducing it, because I'll be able to read through 85 verses just real fast. 85 verses, 55 of those verses contain dialogue. Of the words in the book, 678 of the words are in dialogue, 52% of the book. So half of the words in the book are in a dialogue form. So it's basically a conversation of the book is. And amazingly, Ruth speaks third. She's got the third most, you think she'd have the leading part, the highest speaking part, but she does not. She's third. Okay. We go to Ruth now, please. With that background, I'm going to read through this. First, I want to go to Matthew. Matthew, that's not a good sign, folks. Let's go to Matthew. And look at the genealogy. The genealogy of Jesus, and just look at the names here. Matthew chapter 1, I'm looking in verse 3. And actually, you could go to verse 3 at the very beginning. It says, Matthew chapter 1, verse 3, Judah, that you know who Judah is, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Remember, Tamar is his daughter-in-law, who he has twins with, unknowingly, that you know. And then one of those twins, Perez, had a son named Hezron. Hezron was the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Abinadab. And now we're getting into the Exodus at Abinadab. Abinadab was the father of Nahshon. Nahshon was listed in Numbers as one of the leaders of the people coming out of in the wilderness. Nahshon was the father of Salmon. And Salmon, the father of Boaz, who's in our story today, whose mother was Rahab. So if you go with this, Ruth is going to end up marrying Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. And a reason that's got to be Rahab from Jericho. It doesn't have to be, but what other Rahab is it? Otherwise, they'd want to identify it. There's just this woman just mentioned, again, in a Jewish genealogy from the beginning of the nation Abraham up to the Messiah. There's this woman mentioned. Who is she? It doesn't say Rahab from Jericho, but the assumption is that's who it is. Why? Who else would you mention? So she married a Salmon, who was one of the spies who went into the land. So she marries one of the spies who was hiding out at her place, it sounds like. Salmon was, and she has a son named Boaz. Boaz then marries Ruth, who was a Moabite. So you've got Salmon, who has a son named Boaz. Salmon marries a Canaanite. Boaz marries a Moabite. They're going to have a grandson named David who's going to marry or have his son, who's going to be the next king, marries a Hittite. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. Okay, with that, go back to the book of Ruth, please. Go to the very end of the book. The end of the book of Ruth. The last few verses. And here's how we read verse 16. And again, this is how the book wraps up about Naomi. The story is about Naomi, how she was pleasant, and then it became, you know, bitter and empty for her. And here it is, chapter 4 of Ruth, verse 16. Then Naomi took the child. This child is Obed, Ruth's son. Took the child, laid him on her lap, and cared for him. The women living there says, Naomi has a son. Again, it would be her grandson, but she's lost everything. But through Ruth, she's got a grandson. Now she's got a family name back. She's back in a genealogy. Naomi has a son, and they named him Obed, which means basically worshiper. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And that, again, may be one of the key reasons for this book, is he was the father of David. Thus, then you turn the page, and then you start, you know, talking about where David comes from. You're talking about the royal line. This, then, is the family line of Perez. Now, notice it mentions Perez. Remember, Perez was one of Judah's twin boys. Perez was the father of Hezron, and Hezron was one of those that goes down to Egypt with the family, with Joseph. Hezron was the father of Ram, who would have been born then in Egypt, slavery. Ram, the father of Abinadab. Abinadab, the father of Nahshon. And again, Abinadab and Nahshon were coming out of Egypt, and Nahshon was the head of the tribe of Judah. Nahshon, the father of Salmon, who would be possibly one of the spies, or in this case, he marries Rahab. Salmon, the father of Boaz, who's going to be the word is, the Hebrew word is mighty man, a man of valor. That's what the word describes him. And it can refer to military might, which may be the case with Boaz, especially during this time of the judges, able to protect his property and his rights. But definitely Boaz, as a mighty man, as far as a mighty man in the community, as being wealthy. It's probably referring to Boaz, who is a very wealthy member of the community there in Bethlehem. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David. Okay, let's go to chapter 1 of Ruth. And here we go. Here's where it all comes from. The first thing we're going to see, they're going to introduce the Ephrathites, or Ephratha. And I think I've got that on the notes somewhere there too. But Ephratha is the area of Bethlehem. It maybe is the old name of Bethlehem, the ancient name of Bethlehem, Ephratha. This is where they're moving towards. This is where Rachel died on her way to Ephratha. They're moving towards Bethlehem or Ephratha. And this is going to call these people the Ephrathites, that they were Ephrathites, which may mean they've got some kind of ties somehow into an ancient family name, an ancient family genealogy. Again, they're Israelites, but did they marry into this? But they've got some kind of ties back to maybe the original aristocracy of the city, going way back into the days of Judah, Jacob, Abraham even. And so they've got ties, which is going to kind of show up in Boaz, because Boaz is going to have this property. He's going to be a landowner. And then when you talk about David, David's brothers were all prominent young men, because Jesse was also a man of prominence or aristocracy here in Bethlehem. So here we go. Chapter 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, okay, we know where this is at, there was a famine in the land. And that may be referring to this whole economic upheaval that we see right here. There's no doubt about it. If this is the days of the judges, this could just be a straight-up punishment from God. You talk about Deuteronomy 11, I'm going to send famine. And the land was in rebellion. But there's the famine in the land. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. They're going to leave Bethlehem. They're going to leave the land of promise to go to Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name, Naomi. And the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. And again, they're the only reason they're going to be important really in the story is because they're going to marry these Moabite girls. One of them is going to be Ruth and come back. And they're going to be mentioned later on as the story ends. They were Ephrathites. Again, that probably refers to some connection to the original aristocracy of Ephratha. That's what it's always been called, Ephratha. And again, Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. And they went to Moab and lived there. Now it talks about when they went and lived there, they went and lived in the land. That is the word for sojourn, or to go and live as a foreigner in another land with no rights. That's what they're going over there. They have no rights, but it's better to be a foreigner in Moab at this time and have no rights. And again, they had no rights. They didn't have legislation. They had no rights. It was only what people would give them. I mean, the rights that they had, the jobs they had, the money exchange they received was only at the whim of the people. They had no rights. That's what the word indicates. So it was better to leave the promised land during the days of Judges and live as a foreigner with no rights in the land of Moab than it was to live in the land of Judges. And after we've seen the last couple stories, no doubt it'd be better to leave this land, especially because of the famine, and then you've got the chaos of the land itself. Again, I want to point out to realize how quickly David is going to bring this whole system back in line. How David, one great man, is able to take this and rearrange it so that by the time he's done, he can hand the kingdom, a large kingdom, to his son Solomon, who then builds the grand temple in Jerusalem. At this time in Judah or in Israel, it seems impossible. It seems like they're on their way out. It's like they're declining. Verse 3. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. Okay, and it just says that. I don't want to read more into that than we should. But he dies, and that's not a good thing. It definitely means God's not watching him, blessing him, taking care of him. He's eliminated from history. They don't want to read more than that, but he's gone. He died, and she was left with her two sons. At least she's got two sons. They married Moabite women, of course, because they're living in Moab. One named Orpah, and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, so they're going to live in the land of Moab as sojourners, or as foreigners for 10 years, both her sons died. Again, this is a streak of bad luck, a streak of judgment, whatever. They're being eliminated from history. It's terrible. And so she goes from a very desperate situation, and she's going to talk about that. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. Now, you do understand, I mean, just think about this. In the land of Israel, and I'm pointing at this map. I'm going to draw something on here, so I'm pointing at something besides a blackboard. Did you guys notice that? Or just used to me doing strange things up here? There's Jerusalem, there's Bethlehem, here's Moab. At least I'm pointing at something now. Okay, Bethlehem. In the land of Israel, it was very important for a woman to have a family, to have a man that would have some kind of means of taking care of her and supporting her. And along with that, it was very important for her to have sons. We even talk about this in our own lives, Tony and I. I wanted to take care of Tony, but I realized that her family seems to live longer than my side of the family, maybe 20 years. So there may be 20 years where, I'm gone, I'm in the promised land, and she's down here grinding out a living. So I'm trying to set the stage for her. But one of the things that we do talk about is, what does she have? She's got what? Six sons. And I've talked to all six sons and said, hey, when I check out, you take care of Mom. Well, now look right here, the same thing here in this case. When the husband dies, she's got two sons. But now her two sons dies. Now you've got a woman who is eliminated from anybody's genealogy. She has no connection. Her husband's gone. Her sons are gone. And that would be bad news in Israel. But now she's a sojourner. She's a foreigner in a foreign land with no rights. No husband, no sons in a foreign land. And fortunately, she does have these two daughter-in-laws who kind of step up. And this is a great, I'm sure there's a lot of women's studies that do the Book of Ruth because of this very thing. You've got a foreign woman with two foreign daughter-in-laws here, Moabites, and they're going to be bouncing back and forth. And it's really a great story about the women making things work. Okay. Verse 6, when she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them. Now again, how did the Lord come to the aid of his people? If you read that in the language of the book of Judges, it doesn't necessarily just mean he sent rain. It may mean he sent Jephthah, or somebody that came in and drove out the people that were invading him. God sent, because he'd bring that judgment on them during the book of Judges, that cycle, and then he'd bring a deliverer and come to their aid. And that may be right here. Again, I'm just speculating, but it would fit time-wise. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people, which could be one of the judges rose up like Jephthah, by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. And as we talked about, they might have gone across here, gone all the way down around. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. In other words, I don't want to put you in the same position I was in. You're going to come over here and you're going to be a foreigner in a foreign land. You're going to have no rights. Stay here. Go back to your mother's household. Find somebody else to marry. Get into somebody else's genealogy or family so you can be taken care of. May the Lord show you kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me, meaning their husbands and to her. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. She blesses them as far as moving on with their life. Then she kissed them and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi says, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Meaning she's going back to nowhere. She's got to go back to Bethlehem, hopefully find some family members. But she's, you know, she's got, her sons are dead. She's got nothing to bring to the, any kind of a dowry or anything. Why would you come with me? I am going to have, am I going to have more sons? Who could become my husband? In other words, I'm done. My ball game's over. Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? You're still going to be cut off. You have nobody. You've got to marry into my family and there's nobody going to come. Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you because the Lord has gone. Lord's hand has gone out against me. At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung on to her. This is where the division is made. Not necessarily a right or wrong decision, just the way they answered the situation. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. Don't do this. Go back with her. Go back to your people. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die and there I will be buried. Now that is a huge statement in the ancient world, to be buried somewhere else away from your family. And remember how even Jacob and Joseph down in Egypt both made people commit that they'd be buried in the land so that Abraham and Isaac are buried here. Jacob and Joseph are buried here. All the fathers want to be buried in the land of Israel. That was where their family was buried. She is forfeiting. That's not important. I want to stay with you. So that's a huge, not such a big deal for us, you know. Maybe in our culture, maybe for other people it is, but in our culture it's not. But verse 16, but Ruth replied, don't urge me. Okay, I said read that. Verse 17, where you die, I read that. Verse 18, when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. That's where Ruth was from. Naomi was from. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred. And that is not just a mild word. Stirred means considerable excitement. There was some excitement in the town of Bethlehem when Naomi came back. Because she is somebody. They know her. She's been gone for 10 years, a decade. And that word stirred means a considerable excitement because of them. And the women exclaim, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant, she told them. Call me Mara, which means bitter. Now, remember, I said the story begins with her being Naomi pleasant. Her name is going to be switched to now she's bitter, rightfully so. Husband's gone, sons are gone, she's destitute. She's had a lousy last 10 years. You know, somebody, how's your day been? How's your last 10 years been? Terrible 10 years. So her name's bitter, but do realize how the book ends. She names Obed, is named worshiper. And so it goes from pleasant to bitter to worshiper as God continues to unfold His plan in her life. She says in verse 21, I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as barley harvest was beginning. Now they have, again, this is a big, in Bethlehem, that is what Bethlehem is known for. It's the food basket in the area here. Barley would be the first, barley and wheat are growing at the same time. Barley is going to be produces the coarser bread, but it is going to be the one that comes to fruit first, and then wheat is going to follow it. So barley harvest is just starting. That means wheat harvest is just going to follow right on the tail of this, but they're getting the barley in first. It's not going to be the best bread, but it is useful. And then the wheat, the better grain, will follow that. So they're right there at the harvest time. So thus the story is set up. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech. Okay, there's the name. A man of standing. There it is. That is the word. It means a mighty man of valor. It's used throughout. And you go back even in Genesis. You see that word being the mighty men. David's mighty men, the men of valor. It can mean militarily great. It can mean socially prominent. It can mean, you know, wealthy. And Boaz, that's him right here, it's NIV translated, a man from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing or a mighty man of valor, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, again, remember, just put this in mind, this Boaz, that would be Rahab's son. This is Rahab's son. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, and his dad may have been one of the, he was fighting with Joshua. Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Now, as you know, in the law of Moses, I've got the reference right here, I think, Leviticus 19 and 23, it looks like. But anyway, you know the story. The Lord, in the law of Moses, there are certain places of the field they weren't supposed to harvest. Say like the corners or the places that are more difficult to get to where you got to back the tractor up and get in there and get the, you know, they didn't have tractors. But, you know, they've got to go out of extra work to get in those corners or the places that are more difficult. Leave them there. Don't go, don't put the extra effort there. Leave them there for the people that want to work their way back there and get those crops for the poor. Also, if anything fell, there are certain things, if things would fall, you would leave it there. It was a bad man, a stingy man, who completely harvested his field. Got all the corners cleaned out, picked up, went back, sent the workers back, and picked up anything you dropped, and didn't leave anything. We'd call that being prudent, you know, not being wasteful. They are saying, no, that's part of the system of taking care of the poor. And that is a law. That was the law of the land. But notice here, she says, whose eyes I find favor. She's still kind of counting on the fact that even though it's a law, again, Israel at this time is not known for following the Mosaic law, but it is still there. She's saying she's counting on finding favor. Maybe someone will let me do that, because there may be people out there just stripping their fields, leaving nothing for the poor. Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in the field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Okay, now that's the same clan as Naomi's family's from. And so she goes out, finds a place, and she's working. Now again, you can imagine the harvesters are doing their work. You know, they're picking everything. But if they drop something, they leave it there. And Ruth is just coming by like others and just picking up the stuff that's dropped. Again, in certain cases, I would assume that some people are going to be very particular, chase these poor people off their property, get out of here, and go back and get my crop, you know, to pick up all the stuff that you've dropped. But in this case, Boaz, who's appears to be a godly man, appears to be a moral man, appears to be a man of valor, a mighty man, his workers are working, and if they drop something, they leave it, they just keep on moving. There's certain places in the field that aren't being harvested, and Ruth is out there finding favor. She's picking up, following the harvesters. As it turned out, she's in Boaz's field. Verse 4, just then Boaz arrived. Now you can see the coincidences. She goes off to find a field. Okay, she finds a field. She's in Boaz's field. Okay, she's following the harvesters in Boaz's field. And guess who shows up just to check on how the progress? Meaning Boaz isn't out working in the field. He's out observing the process. He's going to be protecting his grain. He's going to be involved in the process. But he shows up just kind of check on the workers or something. Then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. Notice he lives in the city. He comes out to check on the harvesters working in his fields. So he's a property owner. "The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you," they called back. So this is him and his workers. So again, that's nice to hear the name of the Lord being passed around in a greeting in a positive way at this time in culture, in this history. Boaz asked the foreman of the harvesters, whose young woman is that? Who's the young girl over there? Now, why is he drawn and notices her? I don't know, but he knows, who is that? The foreman replied, "She is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi." Now again, do realize Boaz is in a position where he's not married at this time. And so he's checking, maybe checking out the young ladies. And there's the nice young lady. Who's that? Who's that? I'm just adding to the text wrongly, probably. Okay. Always be careful of people who add to the text and read between the lines. But anyway, he recognized her. The foreman replied, "She is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi." Now, how does he know that? Why does he know that Naomi came back from Moab? Well, over there in verse 19, it says there was a stir. The city was stirred. Everybody knows she's back, and everybody knows this Ruth, this Moabitess, has come with her. So people probably know who she is. Boaz probably doesn't yet, but he does now. Okay. She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters." She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. So you see right here, he quotes her in verse 7. He said, that she says, please let me glean behind among the sheaves behind the harvesters. And he says, that's what she's been doing all day. She's been there ever since she got here this morning, with except for a short rest she took in the shelter. Now, here's how their day would begin. They'd begin before the sun came up because, again, it's going to be hot in the middle of the day. And so they'd begin. They'd be out in the field. So as the sun is rising, they're already working. They're not getting their coffee. They're already in the fields working. So the sun rises, they're working. But then in the heat of the day, they'd then take a break, maybe go to the shelter, and the shelter would be some kind of shade protection. So she's been there since the start of the day, working all morning until it's break time, the sun's too hot, and she took a short break in the shelter, and she's back in the fields picking up crops. Now, again, she's harvesting for herself and Naomi, and she's collecting this that they're going to be using during the season. Verse 8, so Boaz said to Ruth, my daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled. She finds favor. He says, go. He says, I've given them orders. You can follow along with my servant girls who are coming along picking some stuff up. And you can go ahead and get some water out of there. You can go right there and get water from their jars. And this is interesting, especially in the book of Judges. I've told them not to touch you. What do you think he's talking about? Well, read the book of Judges. It's pretty clear. Okay, verse 10. At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? Boaz replied, here's his answer. I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law. So there it is. He's been kind of paying attention. Since the death of your husband, you've been with your mother-in-law this whole time. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. In other words, she says, your God will be my God. Apparently, this whole conversation, he does know who she is. In fact, he knows her history. He knows her attitude. He knows that she's come over and even admitted that your God will be my God, that she's over on his side now as far as worship. Verse 13. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, she said. You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I did not have the standing of one of your servant girls. I want to stop right here and just know, is this not a refreshing story in the land of Israel during the days of the judges? Of all the wickedness, you got Samson and his story going. You got Jephthah there sacrificing his daughter. You've got the Levite and his concubine chopping her up in pieces because she got raped all night by the men up there and from the tribe of Benjamin. And then you come back down here and now you've got Boaz. I mean, it's like, about time we find a guy like Boaz in the story in the time of the judges here. So, I mean, this is, again, it's even more impressive that a man like Boaz lives and exists in this culture. How hard would it be to live in this culture this time, the days of the judges, and be a man like Boaz and have that kind of standing, that kind of a moral fiber, that kind of commitment to the Lord, being able to even talk. This is probably the first time, and I may be exaggerating, maybe one of the first times we've seen in a long time since we started the book of Judges that the name of the Lord is mentioned in a logical sense. The name of the Lord's been thrown around, but it's been thrown around with idols and child sacrifices and all kinds of weird stuff. And here it seems to be making sense. This guy, I think, has some kind of theology. He's got some kind of understanding. Well, anyway, verse 14. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar. When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. That'd be like, you know, that'd be some nice stuff. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. She got up to glean. Boaz gave orders to the men, even if she gathers among the sheaves, the stuff that we haven't started harvesting yet, don't embarrass her. She may not know that. Don't touch the sheaves because that we're not over there yet. You can't be taking that. We're going to go get that later. And if she's already over there taking it, let her go. Don't holler. Let her take it. We don't need it. Let her gather there. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. And you look down there, it's about 3/5 of a bushel of grain. Notice it says she threshed it herself. So she's picked up the grain, then she's going to thresh it, get rid of the part that is not useful, so that all she's got is the grain left. She does that herself, packs up. Verse 18, she carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten. No, so in other words, the roasted grain. She says, "Hey, I brought home my leftovers." So she's got a lot of grain for them to use at home, and she brought home, you know, what do you call those, a doggy bag or something. Verse 19. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work?" Blessed be the man who took notice of you. What a nice guy. That's very nice. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz, she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He, God, has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. Meaning, he's still being faithful to her husband and his sons. She added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers. He's in line as far as being a kinsman redeemer. Now we've entered a new subject here. And a kinsman redeemer, as you know in the law of Moses, it came up in Jesus' conversation there with the Sadducees and the Pharisees. When they talked about a man had a wife and he dies, but then his brother marries the wife, and then the brother dies, and then another brother marries the wife, and pretty soon seven sons have married this wife, and then finally the wife dies too. And you know the story, the Sadducees are talking about the afterlife. They didn't believe in the afterlife. They didn't believe in angels or anything like this. They're trying to make the Bible ridiculous. In the afterlife, whose wife is she going to be? Because they all went into the afterlife now. And now she shows up, and there's seven guys, honey, honey, honey. And it's like, oh, I've got seven husbands. And so they laugh, ha, 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 what a ridiculous story. And Jesus says, you're an error because you do not know the Scriptures, nor do you know the power of God. Keep laughing, but you don't know the power of God, nor do you understand Scriptures. Go ahead and continue your darkness, basically. But the idea there was, in the Old Testament, in the law of Moses, because how dangerous it was for a woman to be lost, you know, without a family, is if a husband died, that woman and whatever went with that husband, his property and everything that was with that okay, I'm rambling here. The man and his wife, they've got this property that they own, they've got a family, they got an estate. The husband dies, that property stays with the woman. But now it's the brother's responsibility to marry the woman, so that she's got a place, so she's plugged into society. Otherwise, she's just out by herself. So now she's plugged in, the brother marries the woman. But along with that, he would also get the estate. And any children that she would bear would be, you know, her estate would be given to her children, and part of the man's estate would be given to her too. All right, let's draw an illustration. Does this make sense at all? I really feel like I'm rambling here. So here we go. You've got a wife right here, and she's got a property. And she's got, land, whatever. She's got, we'll just say wealth, whatever. Okay? Now, this brother, this is brother number two. Brother number one died. So brother number two now, he's the kinsman redeemer. He's got to marry this woman. He's got to marry this woman. And when he does, he gets the wife, which could be good or bad, but he gets the wife. And he gets the property that comes with her. If they have a son, this son is not recognized as his son. It's recognized as brother number one. The one who died, it's recognized as his son legally. You know, they still play ball together. They still, you know, go fishing together. But legally, this son gets this estate. That's why. So now the wife has got a son to take care of the estate, so she's still got a family. But this brother number two, he also has property. Part of his property would also go, because this son is also his son, would get a kick of this property. Not a bad deal right here, because you're going to get estates from two different directions. So this son, this man is going to give some of his estate. Does that make sense? So anyway, that's what a kinsman redeemer is. And Naomi says, this is great because Boaz is our kinsman redeemer. If he could play into this whole thing right here, which would mean their son, Ruth's son, would get a part of the kickback here from Boaz, but also get Naomi's estate that was left to her by her husband. All right, so here we go. She says, this is good. He's a kinsman redeemer. Where am I at? Does anybody know where I'm at? Okay, then the Ruth, verse 21, chapter 2. Then Ruth the Moabite says, he even said to me, stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it will be good for you, my daughter, to go with his girls, because in someone else's fields you might be harmed. And again, think the time of the judges. So Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean. Boaz, once again, I'm going to point out, Boaz is like a safe haven here in a wicked, wicked culture. So Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvest were finished. Remember, barley harvest is finishing, and as soon as that wraps up, here comes the wheat, the good crop. Makes the fine bread. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Chapter 3, verse 1. One day, Naomi Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? Tonight he will be winnowing barley in the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he finishes eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." In other words, she says, okay, tonight's the night. We know what's going on. He's going to be finishing up his barley, the threshing. Then they're going to sit down. They're going to have a meal. But you just kind of stay in the shadows. Don't be out there where everybody knows where you're at. So that everybody goes home. Good night. See you tomorrow. Get up early. Yeah, have a good night. And he's going to go in and he's going to get ready to go to bed. And when he lays down, that's when you go in there and you present yourself to him. Now, this is a touchy verse right here. Even the way it's being worded, it almost sounds a little risque, even in the Hebrew. But as you balance this all out and you read the story, nothing immoral is taking place, although the wording could be led. You could go that way with it, the way it's worded, especially during the time of Judges. She's to go in there, and even the phrase, lay down by his feet or uncover his feet, is also phrases used as far as sexuality. And so she's going there, but notice what she says. You go in there and get yourself in a position as far as in with him where he's sleeping. And when he sees you, he'll know what to do. He'll say something. He says, you'll follow his lead. So Naomi is taking advantage of this. And again, he is a kinsman redeemer. He is the one, but we're going to find out he's not the first. He is, if we're just using our simple illustration, Boaz is brother number three. So they're not brothers. Just stay with my illustration here. Brother number one has died, leaving the wife destitute. Now, this is now Ruth is going to come over here. This man right here, we do not know who he is. He's going to come later in the story. He's going to have the right to do this. And Boaz is going to play him really well, real well. And he's going to say, hey, man, you know, if you do this thing, well, I'll tell you the story. You'll know the story when you get there. But this guy has to be eliminated from the legal equation, and then Boaz is the next one that can marry Ruth, and that's where the story is going to go. Well, Naomi is skipping brother number two, because we really want brother number three to be the one, because he's the man of valor, for a lot of reasons, it appears. Okay, verse 5, "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. I mean, they're destitute. I mean, they've got to make this happen. It's not like, well, you've got, what's your other choice? Well, I might go to college and go into, you know, you don't have, this is your play, honey. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, which means, again, eating and drinking doesn't necessarily mean something bad, but he's having a good time talking, had a few beers, wine. He went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Now, again, the reason he's sleeping outside in the fields instead of going home is he's protecting his crops. He's protecting the harvest. This is a great time to come by and start plundering stuff. Do people plunder stuff during the days of the judges? We got all these people coming across the Ammonites, the Canaanites, the Midianites from Gideon's day, coming in. This is when they plundered. This is when the raids come through. And Boaz is out sleeping with his grain. And that kind of makes you kind of wonder. It says he's a man of valor or one of the mighty men. Not only is he prominent in the society or has wealthy, he may be out there directing his military. He may have some kind of military support out there protecting his crops. Nonetheless, because just an old man sleeping by his pile of grain isn't going to stop anybody, the Midianite raiders or something. Well, okay, so he's sleeping there by his grain. Verse 7, when Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet. And that's a very huge phrase in Hebrew. It means more than uncovers his feet sometimes. Uncovered his feet and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. So now we know what she was. She was just lying at the foot of his bed or his sleeping bag or whatever. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are my kinsman redeemer." Let me translate that. That phrase, corner of your garment, it means flat out, marry me. If you want a reference, go to Ezekiel 16:8. That's where the Lord is talking to Israel about marrying them. He says, "I covered you, I brought you in as mine, my wife." He's talking about, you are my wife. So this is no, I mean, you can study it. You can make your own decisions. You don't have to agree with what I'm saying. But I am slam dunking this right here. She says, "I am your servant, Ruth." You know who I am. Now, her request, "Spread the corner of your garment, marry me." since you are my kinsman redeemer. You have the right to marry me and get my property. My children will then inherit the property of my dead husband and will be part of your package right here. Okay? The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. He takes it as a compliment. She's already complimented her on how she's treated her mother-in-law, Naomi. He says, wow, what a kind thing to do for me. You have not run after the younger men. Now, again, just add a little bit to the story. You've got a wealthy older gentleman, I mean, extremely wealthy, a man of valor, and then you've got the young, wild guys, whatever. Which one would be the better play right here? The old guy with the money or the young guy who, anyway. But he takes it as a compliment. I think it's just a smart move on her part. But he says, wow, you could have gone after one of the younger men, but you went after me, an old guy. I take this as a compliment. I mean, in my mind, Boaz is a great-looking guy. He's, slightly grayed, well-built, very wealthy, got nice clothes. Maybe he's not. Maybe he doesn't look like me. verse 11. wait all night for that one. Okay, here we go. Verse 11. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. Watch this. He says, I will do for you all that you ask. In other words, who just proposed to who? She just proposed to Boaz, and he's accepting. He says, and now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you've asked. Yes, I accept your invitation. I will marry you. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. Notice that he says that's important for him. Although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. Whoa. Now, that's quite a legal information. He's just off the top of his head in the middle of the night. He wakes him up from the dead sleep. He's like, well, yeah, but I'm not number one kinsman redeemer. I mean, have you been processing this? I mean, how does Boaz, is this just common knowledge, or is this something that he's already looked into? Nearer than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. He says, tomorrow morning, I'll put the wheels into motion. And Boaz is not going to play around with this. Tomorrow morning, he's going to be at the city gate saying, hey, you got to make a decision. And he's going to be calling this guy out. Stay here tonight, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he is not willing to, surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until the morning. Verse 14. So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could recognize, meaning that was part of their integrity right there. Don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. He says, don't let anyone know that you're here because you'll get a mark of being immoral, kind of being passed around or something during the harvest time here. He says, don't let anybody know you're here. Verse 15, he also says, bring me the shawl you were wearing and hold it out. When he did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley. That's about, it's like 60 to 90 pounds of barley, and put it on her. Then he went back to town. So now he goes to the city gate. He goes back to the city where his house is at, most likely. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, how did it go, my daughter? Because, Naomi was up all night, what's going to happen, what's happening? It's like, some big evening event. Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her and added, he gave me the 6 measures of barley, 60, 90 pounds of barley, and says, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Then Naomi says, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, because she knows he's taking care of it down at the courthouse, which is the city gate. And again, we know about the city gates. They'd have chambers. You'd walk in, but they'd have 3 chambers on many of these gates. Had 3 chambers on one side, 3 on the other. Maybe just had 1. Many of them, Solomon's had 3 on each side. And the men would meet there in the city gate. That's where everybody came and went. Well, here we go. Chapter 4, verse 1. Tick, tick, tick. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz, so everybody's getting up in the morning. They've slept. He goes to the city gate early. Now everybody's getting up to go to their fields or go wherever they're going to go for the day of business. They're walking. The city gate would be locked, in the evening to protect the people in the city. Now the Bethlehem gate's open and everybody's passing by. And here's this is brother number 2, the kinsman redeemer, is walking out the gate on his way to whatever business he had. Boaz says, come over here, my friend, and sit down. So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and says, sit here. So Boaz is collecting people. Kinsman Redeemer's here. He's collecting some of the elders, the officials, as they're going about the city day. He's forming his, they're not just sitting there waiting to have a meeting. He's starting the meeting. He's forming the meeting. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling a piece of the land. Now watch how he plays this. He doesn't tell him the whole story. He makes the guy jump, makes the guy make a move, and then he nails him with the whole package. It's like, oh. Boaz took the 10 of the elders. Okay. He says, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling a piece of the land that belonged to her, our brother Elimelech. I thought it should bring I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know, for no one has the right to do it except you, and I'm next in line. In other words, I'm really anxious to get a hold of this property. I would really like to have it, but I can't make a move until you say yes or no. Please, I hope you say no. Oh, I'll do it. Oh, okay. I will redeem it. Oh, okay, verse 5. On the day you buy it, okay, if you're going to do this, on the day you buy it from Naomi and from Ruth, the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead man and his property. So in other words, yeah, you get the property, but you also get the wife, which means when you have, and your whole job for having the wife is to have a son. I mean, it's not like, well, we just won't have any children. That's the whole plan. So when you have a son, your son that you don't even know yet, that's going to be her son, is going to get the property and a kickback of your property. Still want to do it? And then he goes, at this, verse 6, at this, the kinsman redeemer says, well, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. Why can't he do it? Because it's not legal? No, it's legal. Why can't you do it because someone else has a right? No, it's yours. Why can't you do it? It'd be bad for me. In other words, that's the wrong. There is places in the law of Moses where at this point right here, the man gets slapped by the woman for rejecting her because he's more concerned about his estate and he rejects this social responsibility. He rejects it. She slaps him publicly at the city gate. That's what's supposed to be done. Or spits on him or something. And so this man right here is actually doing something very selfish. He's violating the code right here. But it's his right. If he wants to be known as more selfish about himself than doing his social responsibility, it's not unlike the rest of the culture. So Boaz got him set up. On the day you buy the land from Naomi and Ruth, the Moabites, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the man's property. At this, verse 6, the kinsman redeemer says, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. Now, early in the day of Israel for the redemption of transfer property became final. One party would take off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing a transaction in Israel. So what would take place, and this is in the Nuzi tablets also. The idea was this. If this is my property, right here, we're standing on my property. If we're standing on my property, I would lift my, if I'm selling it to Don, I would lift my shoe up. I would take his foot, put it on the property, and that's signing the contract. I just signed the contract. In the presence of the elders, I lift my foot up, put his foot on it, or you just take your shoe off, put your shoe on it, or take your shoe off and put his sandal on it. That would be an exchange of property. There's that verse in Psalms where the Lord says, I will throw my sandal over Edom. You know, it's like I'll cast my sandal. What's he talking about? Throwing his shoe at it. It's like he said, I'm claiming it. That's my land. But anyway, that's another, something that comes up later. Okay. Okay, so it just explains that to you. That's verse 7 explaining it. Verse 8, so the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself, and he removed his sandal. So in the city gate, there's no real property there. So he's just sitting down in the city gate, he takes off his sandal, which means I'm done. I give it to you. It's your play. It's your move. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech. When the man took his shoe off, Boaz bought the property. And he names Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead man, the dead with his property, so that the name will not disappear from among the family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses. I just bought the land. I just married Ruth. Then the elders and all those at the gate says, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have the standing in Ephrathah, and be famous in Bethlehem. Notice it mentions Ephrathah. That's the ancient name or the territory. And it names Bethlehem the city. Through the offspring of the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. So again, mentioning again, that's directly in the line of Boaz is Perez. Verse 13, I'm wrapping this up. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, praise be the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Again, meaning you've now got your welfare package. You've got your retirement package taken care of. Congratulations. You can live in peace through your old age. For your daughter-in-law, again, the hero of the story,
who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons. That's interesting. It's because that's what you'd want, is seven sons. You want a daughter or seven sons? I want seven sons. No, this Ruth has performed more than seven for you, more than seven sons could have done for you, and has given him birth. Verse 16, then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. That's the grandmother. And the woman living there says, Naomi has a son, and she named him Obed, worshiper. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And then there's your genealogy. All right, there's that story. Again, the story's about Naomi. The dialogue is mostly Boaz, and Ruth is like that character that kind of carries the whole thing, kind of holds the whole story together. Again, remember, that's a great story. It's a great story to have right there by the book of Judges. It almost sounds like it could fit in the book of Judges, except the direction of the story is completely positive compared to the negative accounts in the book of Judges. Thank you for your time. I'm going to pray and we'll be done. Father, we thank you again for the opportunity to read your word. We thank you for the record that you've recorded for us. And we thank you for your spirit that abides within us. We ask that we may rise and become the great men of this culture, of this generation, as Boaz stood tall and did the right thing and you blessed him. We ask that we too may do the right thing, that we may manifest your blessings to the people of this generation and begin to manifest your truth in this world. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for being here.